we are not the first country to struggle for our rights. Just the opposite. We're one of the last countries in the world to be struggling to shed ourselves from this colonial act that Israel levied upon us. This is colonialism par excellence. And we're one of the last countries in the world that were colonialized that have not been able to succeed in struggling to remove the colonialization from our life. What we try to convince the Israelis is the only way they can remove their fear is to try one thing that they have refused to try throughout history, which is to end the occupation. End this military occupation and test the Palestinians to see how much we are dying, literally and figuratively, to live in peace. There's one state, there's two states, there's binational state, there's a condominium arrangement, there's a parallel state, there's a confederation, there's a federation. To be honest with you, I can live in any political paradigm that the politicians produce. I'm convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no military solution to this conflict. The Israelis have proven that they cannot win, and we have proven that we don't know how to lose. I choose to negotiate with the elected officials of the state of Israel, whether I like them or not. And just like Israel doesn't want me choosing its representatives, I expect Israel not to try to choose our representatives. We don't even want to decide. We want to give Israel the full ability to decide for itself. What does it want? To end the occupation or to accept us as citizens?
All right, Young and Naive, we are still in Palestine. Can you call this Palestine?
Not only do I call it Palestine, the United Nations calls it Palestine. You can call it whatever you want.
Well, people always like Palestine territories, or it's not officially Palestine, or occupied territories.
The fact is, it actually is Palestine. 138 countries passed a resolution in the General Assembly several years ago, which officially calls it the State of Palestine. It happens also to be occupied by the Israeli military. So many times people might call it occupied Palestinian territory, but it's also the state of Palestine today.
So we can officially call it Young and Naive in Palestine?
Yes.
It's not wrong?
No, it's not wrong at all.
So who are you?
My name is Sam Bahour. I'm a Palestinian American. I was born in the diaspora. My father is from El Bire, the city that we're in right now. And I relocated to Palestine after the Oslo Peace Accords to come back and work in economic development. I actually was part of building the first private sector telecommunications company here. And I've been here ever since. So I've been here throughout the entire 21 years of the Oslo process. I'm a computer technologist by training with an MBA from Tel Aviv University in business.
You mentioned the diaspora. What is that?
The diaspora is the part of the population which is born and raised abroad, outside of Palestine.
Why?
In our case, the diaspora is due to the fact that after the State of Israel was created, there was an exodus of about 750,000 Palestinians that were forced to leave their original homes, which currently is where we call Israel, but that was part of Palestine as well at the time. So those people, when they left their homes, those that left the country, either to the surrounding countries or abroad, are called the diaspora. Also in 1967, the Israelis occupied militarily the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And many people at that time either were forced out or because the conditions became so difficult, they left the country. My father actually left before the 1967 occupation. So any part of the population which is being raised outside of Palestine is classified as the diaspora. So I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, for example. Still a Palestinian, but I happen to be a Palestinian who was born in America.
Okay. So, and you mentioned Oslo or something. What was that?
The Oslo Accords was a peace treaty between the Israeli government, the State of Israel, and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is the official representative of the Palestinian people. And in 1993, the two sides actually signed an agreement that was a five-year agreement that was supposed to end with the occupation ending and a Palestinian state emerging. That didn't happen. Oh. So now we are 20 years into the Oslo agreement, even though the agreement was dated to be a five-year agreement.
So why 93? So
was 99 it was supposed to end.
So what happened the last 15 years?
The last 15 years have been a continuing series of negotiations. The two sides could not agree in 5 years for many reasons, but they didn't agree. So the Oslo Accords is called an interim accords. It was supposed to be an interim period to reach a final solution and two states to be able to live side by side. That didn't happen because the two parties didn't agree. So the
but on what?
What do you mean on what?
Agree on what? What did they have to agree on?
They had to agree on, I believe there were six files, things like borders, water distribution, security, things like security, water, Jerusalem, for example, the status of Jerusalem. The most important file that they had to deal with was borders. One of the other files was settlements. The issue of borders was key because if the two sides could have agreed to borders, a lot of the other things would have worked their way out. For example, if the border was set, then any settlement, illegal Jewish settlement that is on the wrong side of the border would have been seen as wrong and would have to be repatriated inside Israel. But again, they didn't agree on anything. They didn't agree on borders, on Jerusalem, on water distribution, on refugees, or on settlements. So we find ourselves 15 years later still trying to negotiate with third parties always getting involved like the US and the EU, trying to bridge the gap between the two sides. We're no closer today, I believe, than we were at the beginning of the process. The sides are very far apart in their opinions about how these major issues should be resolved.
So what's the big issue with the borders? What's the problem?
I believe the biggest issue is that Israel has no intention whatsoever to allow a Palestinian state to emerge. Remember, let's take a step back and put this into context.
Please.
Prior to the creation of the State of Israel, this was the British-mandated area called Palestine. It went from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. When Israel was created by the use of force, they created a country, and by the way, under international law.
How and when?
In 1948, it started in 1947. In 1948, they declared their independence as a state. That was created by the use of force. And just by the way, under international law, the territory gained by the use of force is inadmissible. But that's a side story.
What does that mean?
It means that it's not recognized as legitimate. Because I can't, because I'm a stronger party, come to your house and take your living room and tell you, too bad, I'm stronger, so now your living room is mine. Just like in that example, you wouldn't accept that, nor would any legal system accept that. International law is similar. You cannot be a party that has a strong military and just come and take somebody else's land. So from the beginning, there was a fault that happened. But when Israel was created, they not only created themselves on a piece of land that the United Nations was discussing as a potential Israeli state, they went further than that. And then in 1967, they occupied the rest of it. So just to make it simple, today, instead of from the river to the sea being the state of Palestine, we have from the river to the sea two bodies underneath, one called the State of Israel and one called the Palestinian Authority. But above both of them is the State of Israel. So the State of Israel controls everything that happens here between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. They partly control what happens in Israel because it's a state and has a governing body, etc. And on the other half of that land, called the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, they control it through a military occupation.
So there's actually, there hasn't been a state of Palestine since 1948, but we are in Palestine.
We are in Palestine today. After 66 years of a struggle, the Palestinians were able to convince the majority of the world to confirm in the United Nations, in a General Assembly resolution just 2 years ago, that the state of Palestine, we might be able to call it a new state of Palestine because it's much smaller than the original British mandated state of Palestine. The United Nations agreed that the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem is the new state of Palestine. That's a huge, huge concession if you think about it, because the Palestinians basically said that Israel is permitted to create their state on 78% of what used to be historic Palestine. So the Palestinians showing goodwill in this conflict gave Israel 78% of historic Palestine to build their state on. And what we're asking for is for Israel to accept that the 22% remaining becomes the Palestinian state. Israel refused to accept that. So we ended up having to go to the United Nations, and the United Nations did accept it. And now the whole world is looking at Israel to see when will they end the military occupation so the state of Palestine can live like any other state in the world.
Every single country? I mean, I'm from Germany, I lived in America.
138 countries accepted it by vote. I believe today every single country is waiting to see when the occupation will end. From the US to Germany, to be honest with you, even a big part of the Israeli population wants this occupation to end. You wouldn't think that if you look at the Israeli leadership, because they don't speak about it as an occupation.
No?
But many Israelis understand that this is a military occupation, and they don't want to send their kids to die in Gaza or into the West Bank. Because they understand that the world has accepted that this is now the state of Palestine. It's much smaller than the original state of Palestine, but that's a concession that the Palestinians gave.
What do the Israeli leaders call it? That's
a good question, because the Israeli leaders have created all kind of language for you in the West. They call it disputed territory. They call it administered territory. They call it territory under negotiations. They call it anything you want except occupied territory, because they're very smart. They understand that if they would call this what it is, which is a military occupation, and then the full weight of international law would apply, and for example, what they did in Gaza would without a doubt be called a war crime, which it is. So if you're a military occupier, there's rules to occupation. For example, one of the rules, if you are the occupier like Israel is that you cannot move your population into the occupied territory. So what is Israel supposed to do? They moved 500,000 Israeli citizens into the West Bank in illegal settlements. That's a blatant violation of international law. If you accept international law applies, every country in the world, including Germany, including the United States, accepts this as a military occupation. The only country in the world that questions if this is an occupation is the country of the occupier, which is Israel.
So how do you convince them to call it an occupation?
The same way we convince other countries to abide by international law. International law has many tools available to it. There's political tools, there's diplomatic tools, there's economic tools. Some of those tools are called boycott, divestment, sanction. That's how black South Africa convinced apartheid South Africa that they have to give up on apartheid.
But that was apartheid. It was worse, right?
The people from South Africa say this military occupation and colonization process is worse than apartheid. I'm not the person to try to compare tragedies. What I do know is that there has to be a use of nonviolent tools, hopefully, to convince the Israelis that not only is this military occupation wrong and illegal after 47 years and it has to end, but more than that. The refugees that were kicked out of Israel in 1948 and have not been allowed to return, Palestinians who are living in Syria and Egypt and Jordan and Lebanon, they must be allowed to come back to their homes. Why? Not because I say they're allowed, because enshrined in international law is their right to return home for refugees. So 66 years later, Israel continues to close the border of Israel for these Palestinians who were from Haifa and from Tel Aviv and from Ashdod to be able to come back home. Not only that, we demand that Israel stop treating Palestinians inside Israel. There's 20% of the population inside Israel who carry Israeli citizenship who are being discriminated against.
Really?
So the Palestinians have three major demands, and they are all aligned 100% with international law: ending the occupation, allowing the refugees to come back home, and thirdly, to stop the institutional discrimination that happens inside Israel itself.
So, I mean, if you say that's law, international law, there's no room for compromise? You won't compromise on those three demands?
It's not for me to compromise. I mean, I, as an individual, can compromise anything I want. But a people do not compromise on rights that are enshrined to them in international law. You don't compromise on your right to live in your house, do you? So why should I compromise on the right to live in my house?
I don't know.
I do. You went to world wars to make sure that your rights are protected. The United States had a revolution to protect its right to liberty, self-pursuit of happiness, and life. So we are not the first country to struggle for our rights. Just the opposite. We're one of the last countries in the world to be struggling to shed ourselves from this colonial act that Israel levied upon us. This is colonialism par excellence. And we're one of the last countries in the world that were colonialized that have not been able to succeed in struggling to remove the colonialization from our life. We've presented many kinds of options to the Israelis. And as I noted earlier, the biggest among them is that we accept you to build your state called Israel on 78% of what used to be called Palestine. And we are going to rename the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem to be the new Palestine. And even that Israel is refusing to accept. So we have to ask a very simple question. Where do the Israelis want us to go? Because we're not going to vanish anytime soon.
So, I mean, wouldn't that make there's Gaza, there's the West Bank. Wouldn't that make two Palestines?
No, it would be one Palestine. If you know Indonesia, for example, it's made up of about, 130 islands. Oh. If you know the United States, Alaska is 12 hours away in a plane, so is Hawaii. Oh. So we're not the first country to be built up of detached land masses. That's a technical issue that a plane or a train or a car can solve. The unit called the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem is not only identified in international law as a single unit, but even in the Oslo Peace Accords, Israel signed off that they accept that those three territories are a single unit politically. So in a way, there's no question that that's one unit. They've taken different realities, but politically, it's one unit, which happens to be made up of three different areas.
Do you understand on the other side the Israelis, though? I mean, can you explain maybe from their perspective how why they behave like this? Why they've been behaving like this for the last 20 years? Maybe they're afraid of something. Will happen, that terrorism will come to their country.
No, I can't speak on behalf of the Israelis. When I go to the Bronx in New York, I'm scared, but I don't send in an F-16 to destroy the Bronx because I'm scared. There is a reality when you are a military occupier, when you have colonialized another person's land for 66 years, you better be scared. When you send up F-16s to bomb residential neighborhoods, you better be scared. The more this occupation persists, the more Israel uses the might that it has in its army to try to batter submission into the Palestinians, the more they should be scared of the victims of their might. What we try to convince the Israelis is the only way they can remove their fear is to try one thing that they have refused to try throughout history, which is to end the occupation. End this military occupation and test the Palestinians to see how much we are dying, literally and figuratively, to live in peace.
But maybe they are afraid of the test. Of this test.
The alternative is a never-ending military occupation. The alternative is a continued military-oriented society in Israel that will live for generations on fear. I don't think that's a sustainable way to build a country. So I think it's in their deep interest to end the occupation. If they don't, the result will be that the Palestinians will come to a point, and I actually think we may be very close, if not already there, where the Palestinian side will say, the new generation of Palestinians will say, we are too weak to create a state, so we are going to drop our bid for statehood, and what we want are equal rights. So Israel has to decide, does it want to allow a Palestinian state to emerge like the world is calling for? Or is it ready to see this struggle change from a struggle for statehood to a struggle for civil rights? And that's a very different paradigm.
So that would mean like one state solution?
that would mean a state that has equal rights for all the people under the entity which is governing that state. So it could be one state, it could be a binational state, it could be a one state with one vote per person. There's many different options. You know, we've been told in history by the media mainly that there's only two options for this struggle to end, one state or two states. I happen to be a student of history, and I don't believe that the world is so bipolar. There's one state, there's two states, there's binational state, there's a condominium arrangement, there's a parallel state, there's a confederation, there's a federation. To be honest with you, I can live in any political paradigm that the politicians produce, but any one of them has to have equality at its crux, because I cannot live as a lesser of a human being than the Israeli side. I can live as an equal with Israelis in two states, two independent states living as equals in the Middle East. I can live as an equal inside the state of Israel, which happens to be all of the land, if that's what they want. I can live in any political arrangement. What we cannot live with as Palestinians is to be subhuman, to be dehumanized, like we saw in Gaza last month. That scenario cannot sustain itself, and I would urge the Israelis to understand that to relieve their fear, they have to understand several key things. One, they exist in the Middle East. They are not the 51st state of the United States. They have to understand they're not part of Europe and they're not part of North America. They are part of the Middle East. And to be part of the Middle East, you cannot maintain yourself as a military occupier. The day Israel ends this occupation is the day that the rehabilitation process starts. And it will take some time, but I'm convinced that there'll be two different generations of Palestinian and Israelis who are going to learn how to live together and not build walls amongst themselves. But for that to start, we have to get the boot of occupation off of the Palestinians' neck. And anyone who wants to convince me that the boot of occupation should stay on my neck should be scared.
Do you consider Hamas terrorists?
No, I consider Hamas an organization, a political party that has a militant part to it, very similar to how I viewed in history the Israeli Zionist organization that had the Stern Gang or it had the Haganah. Many political parties in anti-colonization movements have a militant arm to them. So what I term them doesn't matter. Do I agree with how they view militancy as being a source of getting out of the conflict? I don't. I'm convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no military solution to this conflict. The Israelis have proven that they cannot win, and we have proven that we don't know how to lose. And we have to come to the realization, both sides, that there is no military solution. The solution, in my opinion, has to be driven and informed by international law. That's what international law exists for, to solve conflicts. The day we drop international law and accept ourselves to fight it out is a fight that will never end. So I don't accept the acts of violence from either side as being a way out.
But isn't there like international law that says Hamas is a terror organization, like EU and US says?
You're mixing things. And because the United Nations is one thing. The United Nations doesn't call anybody a terrorist. They don't have a list. Okay. States do have lists. For example, the United States has termed Hamas terrorist. Other states have not. That's the prerogative of the state. I don't follow the U.S.'s role or the German role or the Portuguese role. I follow the United Nations. And the United Nations has very clearly identified that the representative of the Palestinian people is the Palestine Liberation Organization. So the Israelis have to do business not with this faction or that faction. They have to do business with the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people. And there's no question of who that is. It's the Palestine Liberation Organization. We have representatives sitting in Ramallah, and we have representatives sitting in the United Nations. If they want to talk to the formal representatives of the Palestinians, they know the address. To create an argument that because Hamas exists, or because X, Y, or Z faction exists, we can't do business, is a very poor excuse. Because we as Palestinians can look into the Israeli community and find also on their side several factions which are militant, which are blatantly racist, We saw a lot of that during the last month of killing in Gaza.
Really?
I don't choose to do business with X, Y, and Z Israeli faction. I choose to negotiate with the elected officials of the state of Israel, whether I like them or not. And just like Israel doesn't want me choosing its representatives, I expect Israel not to try to choose our representatives.
So you mentioned a lot of possible solutions I've never heard of. I mean, I always heard of one state and two state. You mentioned like, okay, maybe explain what's the difference between one state solution and a binational solution, for example.
There are different flavors to a one state solution. A one state solution can be binational. It can recognize that there are two nationalities which are governed within one governing body. Belgium.
Okay.
For an example. There's also the US style, which is not a binational. It is a one person, one vote, one state, where everyone has equal rights. That's another flavor of one state. We've actually recently...
Is it like a republic?
The U.S. is like a republic.
So a republic could be possible too.
I can live with any solution that the politicians can come up with, as long as equality is the foundation of the solution. I have no excitement for one state or two state or federation or confederation. All of them will work for me, as long as I'm treated as an equal person with my rights assumed. Other than that, it will not be sustainable. We've actually proposed recently a practical solution to get us out of the conflict. A British researcher, Tony Klung, and myself, we've produced a document that has been published recently, yesterday, which is proposing the following, that we're coming up on 50 years of Israel's military occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And we think in 3 years, it'll be 50 years. 50 years is a long time. It's plenty of time for Israel to decide if this is an occupation, it has to end, or if it's not an occupation, then they have to assume the Palestinians as full citizens in the state of Israel. So we propose that a deadline be given to the Israelis by the international community of 50 years of the occupation. Decide. Either end your occupation or absorb the Palestinians in Palestine as your citizens and treat them equally. And we think that will be enough pressure to get Israel to make a decision. We would hope that decision would be for two states living side by side, two independent states, as the international community has defined. But if they cannot make that decision, then they should not be allowed to treat us as subhuman, deny us our rights, deny us our water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 50 years is a very long time to live under military occupation. And we're just simply saying it has to come to an end one way or the other. And this is a very peaceful way to propose that we don't even want to decide. We want to give Israel the full ability to decide for itself. What does it want? To end the occupation or to accept us as citizens?
But are these two options not two bad options for them? One, they would have to say, okay, it's an occupation, they would have to end the occupation, or they would have to end their dream of a Jewish state, right?
Possibly. I don't go by their desires or fears. I go by international law. The other option is to keep the occupation in place forever. If anyone, especially after last month in Gaza, if anyone really thinks that an occupation, a military occupation, can sustain itself forever, has not read history.
Well, there has not
been an occupation that has sustained forever. The Turks were here before the Israelis. They sat here for 400 years and their occupation ended. Israel's occupation forever is not a solution.
Like the first episode we ever did here was with Dan Shiftan. He says he's an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu. And he was like, the status quo right now, the occupation and all that, that's the best way they can think of right now. They seem to be satisfied. He says satisfied with the status quo rather than either choosing to give up the occupation or do something else.
Ask the 50 mothers of the Israeli soldiers that died in Gaza last month if they think the occupation is okay as it is. This is insane. It is insane to think that you can actually militarily occupy a people forever. History has proven that cannot happen. Not only that, this occupation is corrupting Israel from the inside. It's creating a militaristic society that not only are there soldiers dying trying to defend an occupation, but their society has become more violent. They have become more racist. This is eating away from Israel from the inside. So if I was Israeli and I loved Israel, I would want to end this occupation tonight, not tomorrow. Not because I love the Palestinians, because I want to secure Israel's future. Anyone who promotes a continuing of the occupation forever is putting Israel's future at risk.
But their future is supposed to be a Jewish state.
For who? When you tell me Jewish state, and as a German person, to tell me Jewish state, you are insulting me to the nth degree. Why? To me, the word Jewish state in Israel is the most racist, anti-Semitic remark anyone can tell me. Why? Because what does it mean? It means that you're telling me indirectly, maybe directly, that the only place a Jew can be a full Jew is in the state of Israel. I detest that. I think a Jewish person should be able to be a Jewish person in Israel, in Germany, in New York, and in Ramallah. There is no one place where Jews can be a full-fledged Jew. When you're saying that Israel is the Jewish state, you're saying that other places will not give Jews their full rights. To me, that's a very anti-Semitic remark. So this, what I believe is a political ploy, which is very emotional, calling for a Jewish state, I think is a political tactic that's being used to delay Israelis to find a way to reach an end to this conflict. If a Jewish state, as you proposed, is so important to the Israeli side, why don't they go to the United Nations and change their name and call it the Jewish state of Israel? Other countries in the world did that. For example, Iran. After the revolution in 1979, they went to the United Nations and they added the Islamic Republic to their name. So if it's so important, why are Israelis begging for the Palestinians to give them a birth certificate? Why don't they go to the United Nations and make it happen? I don't believe it's that important. I believe it has been introduced mainly by Benjamin Netanyahu, but also previously, as a tactic to be able to complicate negotiations so we can't reach a solution. Because there is no Palestinian in his right mind or her right mind that will accept Palestine, their home, to be Jewish exclusive. No Palestinian can accept that. And the Israeli leadership knows that. Thus, I believe, introduced this negotiating ploy to play on words, trying to make it as if it's a major issue. The issue is not some desire in Netanyahu's brain. The issue is embedded in international law. We either accept international law or we accept the law of the jungle. We had a taste of the law of the jungle last month in Gaza. Israel can decide what it would like going forward. Would it like to abide and comply by international law so we can peacefully find a way out of this? Or would it like to live forever in the law of the jungle, where anything goes?
I mean, on the other hand, we're from Germany. We cover a lot of German politics. And in the end, we always learn that political decisions are also based on interests. I mean, the people want to stay in power. So, and maybe Netanyahu or the Israeli government thinks, okay, if we, you know, have to make a decision, the voters, because it's a democracy, they will hate it and they will vote us out. And in the end, maybe they rather want to stay in power than find a solution.
Politics is a difficult game, and I agree fully with you. It's based on interests. If Germany was not selling submarines, military submarines, to the Israeli side, maybe they can be a little bit more aggressive. But when Germany, for example, and many countries around the world are trading arms with Israel, they become very hesitant to hold Israel accountable when Israel creates war crimes. Yes, I mean, I believe that's what was created not only last month in Gaza, but I believe that's what was alluded to in the Goldstone report back in 2012. And I believe that's what happened in 1948 as well. Hopefully, the UN will hold people accountable moving forward. But ultimately, we have to have a baseline to work with, whether we're German or American or Palestinian or Israeli. Is the baseline going to be our emotions? Or is the baseline going to be embedded in law? So we have to find a place to start. And if we start with our emotions, we'll never end, because everybody has different emotions and they continue to change. If we go to international law, which, by the way, was created, a bulk of it was created based on the Jewish experience in Europe after World War II. We didn't create international law. We didn't create divestment. We didn't invent boycott. These are tools that have been created in the world for their use nonviolently to get political bodies to act. We are merely using tools available to us, trying to get bodies to act. In return, Israel provokes every single day for us to use violence. And sadly, they were successful in Gaza to provoke violence at a level that was unheard of. What I'm calling for today is that we come back, all of us, to our senses and understand there is no military way out of this conflict. We have to abide by the rules and regulations of the international community, which has accepted two states, which has accepted the end to the occupation, which has said settlements are illegal, and let's move forward and build a future together in the Middle East.
But how do we change the interests of the Israeli government, of Netanyahu? How can he not be fearful of making a decision, of actually finding a solution? Because
from our side, we're doing the best we can. I speak to you on camera trying to educate people the way I see a way out, which is nonviolent. The Palestinian leadership has gone to the United Nations and made their case at the highest levels of the United Nations. So diplomatically, we're working on that track. In the civil society, we're working to do civil disobedience, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So our civil society is highly active in a nonviolent way. There's more and more mobilization globally through civil society, putting pressures on countries. Again, using boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This is the way politicians change their opinions, through civil society articulating that this is a way out, that nonviolently we can get countries to change. Nonviolently, we can convince Germany to stop arming Israel so Israel doesn't continue to bomb and destroy Palestinian neighborhoods and cities and infrastructure and kids. We have to influence our countries to be able to do better. And to do better requires civil society to hold their countries accountable. And we're doing that from the United States all the way to inside Israel even.
So what would you suggest? I mean, when we go back to Germany, I regularly talk to the government. I can ask them any question I want three times a week. What should I ask them or tell them to answer in terms of Israel?
I'm not there, so I cannot tell you the best way forward in your own country, but I can suggest, for example, number one is education. I think a lot of politicians are not educated on the basics of this conflict, so I think education is number one.
So watch this show, I guess.
Watch this show. Number two, I'll give you an example that I know of. The Social Democrats have called for an emergency session of the European Parliament to be able to discuss what happened in Gaza last week. I would hope Germany would support that call and bring the Europeans together to do what they already started to do. For example, last year, they issued EU guidelines which stopped funding any Israeli institution that has a connection to the settlements. That can be continued. They can stop doing trade with Israel. They can stop supporting Israel militarily. They can stop buying weapons from Israel. There are many, many things one can do nonviolently to pressure their governments to be able to change path. And we're not asking them to change to an unknown. We're asking them to change to become compliant with international law. That's a rather reasonable request from a people who have been under occupation for 47 years.
But have you ever been to Germany? I mean, every time they might be critical of Israel, there's calls of anti-Semitism and all that.
Of course. There's also last month 20,000 people that came out on the street in Germany. So I think civil society is not able to swallow a continuing of this occupation, especially when the occupation involves killing 2,000 people a month, 40-50% of them being women and children. Civil society is acting in a way which is calling that anti-Semitism bluff. Yes, there is anti-Semitism, and we should all be against it. But definitely calling for the end of a 47-year military occupation has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Calling for Palestinians not to be institutionally discriminated against inside Israel has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Demanding the refugees to come back home after 66 years of living in refugee camps because of Israel's creation has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. So until we're ready and educated enough to be able to separate the real anti-Semites, which we should all be struggling against, especially me, given I'm a Palestinian, which means I'm a Semite.
You are?
Every Arab is a Semite, that we need to be able to fight anti-Semitism together. And we also together need to be fighting against occupation, against discrimination, and against the continuation of a refugeedom for 66 years.
So I heard from, we talked to a British journalist who said there's like a Palestinian Mandela in Israeli's jail. Have you heard of him?
Baguti? There's about 6,000 of them, to be honest with you.
6,000 Mandela.
We have 6,000 people who are sitting in prisons. We have many more that have been killed over the last 60 years. Many of them were promoting nonviolence. By the way, Nelson Mandela did not promote nonviolence. Nelson Mandela was the head of the African National Congress, which had armed struggle as the beginning tactic against apartheid South Africa.
So just like Hamas?
Just like the Palestinians in general.
Okay.
We started this struggle with armed struggle. We've since converted ourselves to a nonviolent movement for the most part.
Except for Hamas.
Except last month.
Okay.
Not only Hamas. The provocation of closing Gaza off, sealing the Gaza Strip, sealing off 1.8 million Palestinians for 8 years, created a tinderbox which exploded. So it wasn't a choice of choosing armed struggle. It was the last resort for survival for those who believe in armed struggle. Sadly, Israel, in 20 years of negotiations, could not come to the table to open the Sea of Gaza, could not come to the table to allow a link between the West Bank and Gaza. Now, after 1 month of a military onslaught, they're sitting in Cairo figuring out how to create a link between the West Bank and Gaza, how to open the sea so fishermen can go fish. Sadly, Israel is only over history responding to violence. They refuse to act when there's nonviolence involved, when there's diplomacy involved, and they only act when they're forced to act by military might. And that's a sad reality, that the only time we can get Israel to act positively and in line with international law is when violence is used.
Are there any leading Israeli politicians who promote nonviolence? I mean, are there any leading politicians who say we should stop that?
I don't know the Israeli politicians by name, but I assume there is. I know in the civil society in Israel, there are many. You have many organizations. First, you have 20% of the population in Israel, which is non-Jewish. They are Christian and Muslim Palestinians inside Israel. So 20% of the Israeli public, for the most part, is speaking very positively about ending the occupation and non-violently. In the Jewish Israeli part of society, I know that there are many efforts. For example, breaking the silence. Israeli combat soldiers who came to the occupation couldn't live with themselves after doing what they did here as soldiers, went back to Israel, organized themselves in a group, and are now speaking out, saying we as Israeli soldiers committed crimes in Hebron and in Ramallah and in Jenin. And they're speaking out not to us, they're speaking out to the Israeli public, saying you have no idea what the Israeli military is doing in the occupied territories. So that's a healthy voice. There's also thousands of people who have been demonstrating in the streets of Tel Aviv. Sadly, they have not been covered well in the media, but they are calling for this war in Gaza. I don't even call it a war, I call it an onslaught, for this military action in Gaza to stop. So you have many elements inside Israel which are calling for the end of the occupation and or the stop of use of this violence in this way, which has been unheard of. So yes, I don't see the Israeli society as one block. I see it as a dynamic society, sadly moving to the right, sadly bubbling at the top are some of its racist elements, but that doesn't blind me to the fact that in reality, the average Israeli family wants what the average Palestinian family wants, to live in peace and security and to raise their children and to have a life. Israelis cannot offer that to themselves when they deny it to their neighbors.
And at the end, I always like my guests to be a little naive, like be a dreamer. Give me a year when you think either like a decision will be made or there will be peace or like a solution.
It's very hard to predict in the Middle East. I've been here long enough not to be a fool to try to set a date. I would say that the generation of Palestinian leadership today is probably the last generation that's convinced that a two-state solution is possible. So I assume my children, I have a 19-year-old and a 14-year-old, I assume that generation, this upcoming generation, is probably going to drop the ball of statehood and call for their civil rights.
So this is
5-10 years from now. If a Palestinian state is not allowed to emerge on the ground, not only in the United Nations, but on the ground, Israel will be faced with a real full-scale apartheid reality. They will be the entity that's responsible from the sea to the river, and the majority of people under their governance will be non-Jewish. And that, in reality, will be, for them, an apartheid situation across the board. And I see my children not begging the world for another 40 years for statehood, but rather struggling for their civil rights. Struggling against who? Struggling against the entity that prohibits their rights, which is the state of Israel today.
So you're basically saying there are only a couple of years left for two-state solution.
Many would say we're already past that time. I would say this is the last leadership generation that is able to maybe make it happen. The president is well into his 80s, I believe. So by nature, this leadership is phasing out. The next leadership, Israel will find not so interested to beg the world forever for two states, especially if the settlement project continues to expand and expand and expand. There will come a point where the Israelis will say, you can't undo the damage that you have done to the West Bank. You cannot undo the damage you have done to Jerusalem. Thus, we no longer are looking for statehood. We are looking for our rights. And next time I talk to you, instead of telling you support Palestinian statehood, I'll come and appeal to you to support my right to sit on the same bus as an Israeli. That's a much more convincing argument.
It sounds like 1960 Rosa Parks.
I'm glad you made the connection. That's exactly where we're headed.
So are you going to be the Martin Luther King?
I'm going to be Sam Bahour in the business sector, trying to make jobs happen and trying to build a country.
When did you go into politics?
Hopefully not.
you seem like a reasonable politician.
Thanks. I have your vote.
If I could vote for you.
Thanks. I appreciate the vote of confidence.
And I appreciate taking time with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll be right back.